Support for WPR comes from Luther College in Decorah, Iowa, a community where students are invited to learn actively, lead courageously, and live purposefully for a lifetime of impact. More about Luther College at luther.edu.
Support for WPR comes from Present Music, performing honest music with guest violist and curator Nadia Sirota, May 9th at 8 at the Milwaukee Art Museum. Tickets and info are at presentmusic.org.
This is Chapter a Day. I'm Susan Sweeney. We're reading from Chef Lisa Donovan's 2020 memoir, Our Lady of Perpetual Hunger. As we pick up today, Lisa's beginning to make her mark in the world of food. It's a local start, on home ground in Nashville, but it isn't long before the circles of her influence and professional connections widen. Our Lady of Perpetual Hunger, Chapter 9. Alice Randall, a Nashville legend, songwriter, and the author of The Wind Done Gone, wanted to know if I would like to have tea. When she spied Charleston Receipts, a revered junior league cookbook, in my bag, and asked me about it, I divulged to her my new obsession, my new studies. She gave me a look I'm now familiar with, the look that tells me I'm about to learn something I should already know. I had started to explore beyond pastry and bread, an obsession with old Southern cookery, pickling and vegetables in particular, had arrived. My books were no longer professional books written by professional chefs, but instead old junior league books, spiral-bound church cookbooks, handwritten note cards in boxes found at flea markets, and ancient newspaper clippings found folded up in all of the above, with some woman's cursive script annotating what she made and for whom. I had started a trove of treasures I'd been collecting for years, the ultimate delights in my life. I felt like this was a weird thing, to be honest, spending hours fawning over old layer cake recipes, caring about caramel cake, trying to reach the heavens with a coconut cake, making them with a freakish kind of yearning, making a record of every antiquated dessert invented and made and bought and sold in American history, and how it came to be. I lived for this stuff, the stories of divinity and ambrosia and aspic pineapple molds and sugar pies and all the bars from lemon to magic seven-layered ones to things called cowboy cookies. At that time, everyone was still mostly spinning the French narrative in food, obviously for good reasons. However, the era of learning French technique and applying it to, say, a chess pie or a simple cookie was not really part of the story for the restaurant industry at large. You still had to prove your worth through brisé and millefeuille and pâte à choux. But my nose was firmly planted in every church cookbook, every ladies' guild or school fundraising cookbook, every old stapled or spiral-bound book of cakes and pies and divinity candies that I could find. I thumbed through Rose Levy Berenbaum's The Cake Bible, just like every other studious baker, teaching herself to get it right. But what those recipes taught me in precision and technique, they lacked in story and real-life meaning for me. So, before I started taking apart the technique of everything, hoping to make it not just nostalgic but good, I started with other recipes, the stories, the feelings from women who signed their recipes as Mrs. Frank Jones and Mrs. William Jenkins and so on. Alice's kitchen was painted white, with a beautiful island in the center, and more than a kitchen, it was a library with built-in bookshelves lining the walls, holding what seemed to be thousands upon thousands of cookbooks and notebooks and books that, as she showed them to me, I realized were the real history books of Southern cooking. Alice had old hand-bound books, handwritten, undated, and full of recipes from those men and women who never got credit, who made the cakes for the white women hostesses to parade out of their kitchens as their own, who wrote recipes based on their own family traditions, traditions that went back to Africa, traditions that the South is built on. Here was the reveal of the gullah traditions that lined the pages of Charleston receipts. Those who really wrote that book, Alice said with firm, unflinching kindness. Everything I loved and had been clinging to and had been trying to build came from the hands of slaves, from domestic workers, from oppressed people who still did not get the credit of their contributions. My indignation came only because I was ignorant. This was obvious information. How did I need to be shown this, I wondered. I had to ask myself what it was about my life that enabled me to evade these conclusions on my own, to not see the real history of the place I was working so hard to understand. Did I think my limited studies of Edna Lewis allowed me to check the box of Southern racial understanding? I knew nothing as I sat there thumbing through Alice's books, hearing her talk about the diaspora, the Great Migration, a thing I had never, not once, learned about in school or from my white Southern family, and her own family's journey, seeing recipe after recipe from some woman's beautiful handwritten notes, notes that weren't meant for tourists or voyeurs to buy or sell, but were meant as directions from one cook to another about how something worked, what to do when provisions are low and still make it good, recipes that certainly were not meant for a white woman to center herself within. Should I choose to sidestep this education, I would merely be carrying on the tradition of erasure penned by Mrs. William Jenkins and her ilk. I could go on my merry little way, making my cakes and having all my big feelings about being a Southern baker, sure. But Alice taught me that I needed to know and honor these things, the real history, and then decide how I wanted to tell the stories of what they were worth. The trick was a simple one. Undo your miseducation. Not everyone has an Alice Randall in their world, and Alice Randall should not have to do this work for us. My relationship with her was built on her kindness and her generosity. I am fortunate, and I am proud to say that after our tea, she became one of my biggest clients and supporters for many years. To this day, we talk about being mothers, being women in this world, and she never flinches in a moment of honesty. The last time I was with Alice, she said to me, "Lisa, sweetie, let me tell you, we are all each other's mothers, all of us women. We have to take care of each other in that way." An Appalachian heart is a very specific thing, and when you meet one, you'll know that to be true. Sean Brock has an explosive laugh, one that feels like it's been brewing in his gut for hours before he lets it erupt. And when he does, it's contagious. He and I became fast friends. We seemed to be on similar journeys as cooks and as humans. He was the first person to care about deep and true leanings I was having in my baking world. And as we got to know each other better, a certain understanding evolved that there was more to our connection than just location, than just being Southern. He invited me to oversee pastry for Husk, and I said yes to the job on the heels of all these overwrought feelings I was having about the South and my place in it. He seemed to be the perfect maestro to help me channel these discoveries about myself into food. I took the job, learned more than I ever imagined as a cook, and also proceeded to have my whole world turned upside down, for better and for worse. Mostly, I believed in Sean's ideals. All our ingredients would have to be sourced within 100 miles of the restaurant's front door. This not only celebrated the South, it tried to have a conversation about sustainable food practices, keeping the restaurant industry's footprint small, doing away with all the damage that transporting food thousands of miles does. And his food? It was brilliant there at the beginning. I can honestly say, to this day, I have never met anyone with a brain like Sean's. The complexity with which he followed a thought through taught me more about how to cook than likely anything before or since. He took my emotional foundation of thinking about and cooking food to another level, one that started with seeds and origin and historical relevance. My enthusiasm became effective action, real work, the ability to think bigger than the plate. I started looking deeper, more closely, more broadly. Initially, it all felt like a whirlwind, but eventually I found my pace, at least when it came to menu writing. During this time, I developed what became the thing, the recipe I will not outlive. It's both a blessing and a curse to make the best version of something. Best being debatable, I'm sure, by anyone who has their own version of it. Not debatable was the fact that my buttermilk chess pie took hold, grabbed the attention of all our customers, and, less important, the media. I would never claim to make a perfect version of anything, but this pie comes pretty close. Despite my pride for it, I tried to take it off the menu once at Husk, determined to keep building similarly inspired desserts, moving on to other things, other projects. But that only lasted one day. The demand was too strong, and I was forever tethered to that pie as an identity of sorts. Because I was proud of it, I came to terms with it being a constant in my life. We were cranking out two services a day, 7 days a week, trying for 3 turns each service with a dining room that had nearly 100 seats and a private dining venue out back. Keeping that pace while being at the top of your game creatively was challenging for us all. We were all there to work with Sean, who was becoming known on an international scale at this point as a prodigy of the South. However, I also did not know that I was agreeing to work with a company that cared more about its investors getting rich and fast than with the well-being and health and careers of its employees. I started to find that cooking was different in this kitchen. It was competitive, mean, aggressive, not about hospitality, but instead about everyone's ego, about Star Chefs magazine coming to interview people, about PR, and about who was impressing Sean the most at any given appearance he made. The kitchen at Husk became toxic in such a way that my family never even wanted to come near the place. People were so bitter and so unhappy, loathsomely so it just seeped into everything you tried to do. An eventual darkness loomed and settled over everything, a meanness you could not escape. For some time, I continued to believe I could do good work and make an impact that was positive and strong, figure out how to be a good leader under pressure. I failed. It was a failure that took me a long time to get over. I was a nationally recognized pastry chef, published in Best Of rundowns, asked to submit recipes to the world. I was asked to speak about what I knew, had people come into the restaurant just to have my dessert, and saw firsthand how much money I had made that company on a daily basis with just my product alone. By my second year there, when I was flying back and forth between Nashville and Charleston to run pastry at both the Husk restaurants, and in turn giving up my entire intellectual property to a company, I was still only making $15 an hour. When I asked for a higher salary and my title to be executive pastry chef, a job I had been performing but had been asked to do just as a favor, I was told I was no longer needed in Charleston. Well, they already had all my recipes and 6 months of nearly free staff training. And beyond unbelievably, I was told I would have to cut one of my pastry cooks down to less than part-time, essentially firing her in order to get my raise. That was when I left. That was the crux of my professional life, not making sense any longer. I had been a witness to and an active participant in a world that would easily kill me if I let it, a world that was driving away people who were smart enough to say that they deserved better within the first few weeks of employment there. And yet, I left feeling ashamed of myself, ashamed of my inability to carry all the weight, to make it all work, to be better for my cooks in ways that now make my own heart break a little. I carried that for a long time. It took me nearly 2 years to see it for what it was and to see just how swallowed up I was within that dark, dank belly of a bloated beast that was the work I once loved and lived for. But I was also smart enough to count my blessings. Saying yes to Sean had brought an entire world of opportunity to me. It brought me the chance to prove myself an expert in my field, to talk in public about what felt like my weird obsessions, to feed my community and reach a far larger one, and to work with younger cooks who wanted to learn about the odd stuff I had collected in my brain. My work with Husk led me toward women in my field, the kind of women I'd never met before, women who would stabilize me when things got really bad, women who stood stronger than anyone I had ever met, women I would find myself in sisterhood with for the rest of my life. No one ever tells you how lonely being a woman who is dedicated to her career, either by choice or necessity, will be. Angie Christensen, whom I once dubbed the patron saint of layer cakes, pays attention and champions all. She's a quietly revered Southern baker who's carried the torch of our traditions with such goodness and skill that people don't even know they're replicating things that she buoyed and researched for her Atlanta bakery in the very early 1990s, before I even had the good idea to do this work. I met Angie for the first time in Florence, Alabama. It was the early years of a now-famed weekend called Shindig. That weekend, we swam in the Tennessee River, listened to people talk about sustainability in our work, and shared ideas about how to keep bringing the South up and over the cultural bumps of our region. We listened to Jack White and the Alabama Shakes and Jason Isbell play live to small crowds of mostly Southern folks who spend their lives making things, folks like me who cook, and folks like Angie, who I would soon find out makes every chance she gets an opportunity to celebrate the people around her. That weekend would be my true introduction to Southern Foodways Alliance, which for 20 years has done its best to document the oral histories of the South's foodways, to bring people together over food and words about food, and to ultimately get to the heart of who Southerners are because of it. Founded by mentor and friend John Edgerton, it has almost single-handedly brought the Southern food community together in a way that seems natural. A photographer once leaned into me at breakfast at a Knoxville gathering and said, "I mean, all you Southern chefs can't all be friends, right? I mean, this isn't really how chefs behave. You can tell me. It's all a bunch of bull, right?" She was genuinely perplexed and meant no harm, but she was absolutely incorrect. Angie and I became instant friends, and it did not take long for us to feel like family. Right away, we were finding reasons to cook together, to make a Lane cake for 300. We would travel around putting cracklins on caramel cakes, deep-frying saltine crackers to serve with key lime pudding cups, making our own parade of layer cakes for crowds. By then, I had started to take some responsibility for how I had let things unfold. I had made my choices, and it was my responsibility to unmake them. These weren't choices about jobs or restaurants. These were choices I had made to coddle the powers that be, to let myself be less than those around me, to be afraid of seeming ungrateful to the men who let me into their world, the same men who incorrectly decided what I was worth, time and time again. I had to undo that. That was on me. Inasmuch as Husk broke my heart, It eventually brought me an opportunity to walk into a kitchen with confidence about my contributions and tell my story in my own way. The pantheon of women in my work, who kept me connected and present in a world we all believed in, helped me navigate those tough years. I found myself in a space shared by chefs and writers, men and women alike, who leaned in when I spoke, who talked numbers with me, who gave me a stage to speak, to write, to contribute. I could never have known how deep the rewards would get. Kelly Fields, a New Orleans pastry chef, and my very dear friend and I were invited to cook dessert together in San Francisco for the leather-pant-wearing goddess who is Diana Kennedy. It was an honor of a lifetime. If I had any lingering doubt about my place in the food world, or moreover my right to exist out loud within it, Ms. Kennedy kicked the heck out of it in one fell swoop. Diana Kennedy is the kind of chef and food writer so epically legend that no matter how hard you work or how successful you become, you will never feel you have the right to be in the same orbit to even cook near her, much less for her. Ms. Kennedy is the real deal. She was how an entire generation of Americans learned about Central and South American food because a wild British dame refused to keep her wanderings bottled up, refused to squelch her curiosity, and refused to wait for anyone to give her permission. No one needs to give Diana Kennedy permission to do anything. She is her own planet and makes her own rules. She then proceeded to write a few dozen of the most important cookbooks ever written. To honor Ms. Kennedy, Kelly made a dense and moist cornmeal cake, while I made a cajeta ice cream, a traditional Mexican caramel made of slowly cooked goat milk, also fondly called, by me, milk jam in the South. It was just salty enough for my taste. Then we topped it all off with my buttermilk cream and vanilla-roasted apricots. It was interesting to find that West Coast chefs were not accustomed to buttermilk in desserts, and so, to my surprise, my simple whipped cream with buttermilk and just enough vanilla, sugar, and lemon juice was their main object of interest. I made my tres leches mixture with raw whole milk, buttermilk, and sweetened condensed milk, and soaked Kelly's beautiful and very dense cornmeal cake in it. The cajeta ice cream was spun. I made the buttermilk cream, and then I took those apricots, pitted them, macerated the ripest ones in just a bit of sugar and vanilla bean, took the underripe ones and roasted them on a high heat with a squeeze of lemon juice, sugar, and more vanilla bean, and then once they were cooled, combined everything to make one delicious apricot creation to put on top of the tres leches cake. The young cooks who'd previously been too stressed or could not imagine wanting to know anything from a chef from Tennessee or Louisiana perked up when we started plating. To their benefit, they started asking questions and softening their cold, hard stance once they had a reason to engage with us. Bless 'em. Once they saw our food, they became interested. They especially perked up when two people rushed back separately from delivering dessert, shouting, "Chef Lisa! Chef Kelly! Diana Kennedy wants to see you two! Now!" Kelly and I looked at each other. I was initially terrified. I don't think Kelly is scared of anything, so it's hard to say what was going through her mind at that moment. I went through every possible thing that could have been wrong. Maybe the cake wasn't soaked enough. Maybe the ice cream hadn't been temped as well as we thought. I had come up with no less than 25 possible disasters by the time we arrived at her table, escorted by the host of the event. Diana Kennedy was, as always, wearing her black leather pants, but she had upped her silver jewelry for the special occasion, and even looked to be wearing makeup. She wiggled her finger for us to come closer. Then, when we had our heads by hers, a threesome of strong women faces all collected in a circle, and it felt like we were truly all mind-melding, she whispered, "That was the finest dessert I have ever ever had. Kelly and I both stood upright, straight as arrows, and looked at each other as if we had just met, just seen the light, just gotten some kind of anointment from the universe that not many others had ever received. She asked about details, about the milks, about the apricots, about the cornmeal. We talked out our dish with her, goddess, supreme being Kennedy, every once in a while catching each other's gaze to say, "What the hell?" And then she asked us to sit down. Kelly got accosted by a fan, because she is famous, and I sat down with Diana Kennedy for approximately 4 minutes before she got swept away in her honorific night. In those 4 minutes, Diana Kennedy seemed to want to make a point to me, a point I can't quite figure out how she knew I needed. She asked if I had heard her recording her podcast the day before. I said yes. In the podcast, she talked of the women's spirit in the kitchen, how it rules Mexican culture, how it rules the family, how it rules the hearts of those who get to come closer to the magic of a mother or an abuela. She asked if I was a mother. I said yes. She asked if I cooked for my family. I said yes, of course. And then asked if I had told that story to the world. I said I had not yet told any stories to the world. She then asked me why she'd never heard of me, if I was capable of making these desserts. I said I did not know. And then, as she got up to leave the table, she said, "I do. Stop letting men tell your story." Diana Kennedy knows what she is doing at all times. Nothing is an accident. And she is certainly not just trying to be sage or look cool. She actually is sage and cool, and she can screw you up with a word. My frustrations with my career must have been visible all over me. This was at the height of hearing man after man on NPR and in the New York Times telling stories of their mothers, their grandmothers, anyone whom they felt gave them clout or a sense of humility, and whom, I'm certain, they honored and cherished and wanted to shine a light on, hold up high on that pedestal. The thing is, women are revered straight into abjection, useful only as a totem of inspiration. When we go to make that work our own, we are unable to survive in the industry men built, the one they sell our wares within. In that moment, I accepted that I would no longer allow myself to feel that my sense of womanhood and motherhood is the part of my identity as a chef that I have to undersell and downplay for fear of my professionalism being shrugged off as it has been in the past. I will no longer be afraid to talk about how my strength as a cook rests almost solely in my strength as a woman. I am a mother and I am a daughter. I am a granddaughter who learned at my nana's polyester-panted hips, curvy and full of Mexican juju and mysticism. I have grown up in kitchens with women, and I am now a woman who cooks from that place, in my heart, for a living. I am not driven to be better than any other cook around me, or even to make a perfect version of something. I want to give people food that tastes of our past stories and of our present now, like the good food that all those chefs' boys' mothers used to make. I want that food to be respected and honored in our world from its true origins, not solely from a male chef who has figured out how to build an entire brand about what he has learned from our hands as he stood by our strong, life-giving hips, watching and wishing to God he had some kind of magic that even came close. We're reading from Lisa Donovan's memoir, Our Lady of Perpetual Hunger, published in 2020 by Penguin Books. I'm Susan Sweeney. Join us for more from Our Lady of Perpetual Hunger, next time on Chapter a Day.